Modesto, Stockton, and surrounding areas. This is Leo, and here you're listening to Business and Legal Talk with Leo and Claudine. Good morning, Claudine.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing swell. I am too high on coffee.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a Saturday morning.
That
it's
a
beautiful day. I'm a hopeless positive person.
Absolutely.
And I'm happy to be back with another great show for you guys.
Yes, it's going to be really good today.
It's super, super exciting. I can't wait to... Well, do you want to tell us what we're going to talk about today?
Yeah, we're going to talk about buy-sell agreements.
Whoa!
I know.
Can you hear the excitement?
Woo! You need to. It's something that every business owner should be thinking about. Months ago, I think, or I would weeks ago, we did touch on the idea of structuring your business so that you could sell it. This is going to kind of follow along with that, but it's not necessarily so that you could sell it, although that is a fine idea.
Right.
This is kind of a hybrid of that so that we can... You know, make provisions for the business should something happen and we end up exiting the business for some unknown reason. So we want to have something in place. It's really kind of a practical thing that business owners should be putting in place so that we can protect ourselves. And then the business doesn't just disintegrate should we exit for some reason, be incapacitated or die or, you know, whatever.
Oh, well, let's not
go
there.
I'm trying to avoid going, you know, down that dark road, but you know, it's a preventative measure. And it's something that should be considered all the time.
So I know once I start on that topic, we're probably going to have a hard time getting off the topic. But so let's get started with some fun stuff, easier things, right? I like to start this segment now with just some more, like I call it corporate gossip, right? Or just fun things that are not necessarily on topic. But I think as a business owner, you get a kick out of. So, hey, so I found this thing that kind of gives me news through LinkedIn, you know, a corporate news, if you will.
Right.
But I was just reading this article. And if it is in LinkedIn, it must be true. Many new fathers are still hesitant to take prolonged time off work for fear of harming their careers. Hey, how about that? So many new fathers are still hesitant to take time off work for fear of harming their careers. This is even though companies are offering more and better paternity leave. However, a report in the Wall Street Journal highlights a company whose founders both took 3 months of paternity leave at the same time, despite the corporate and cultural taboos. While their absence increased the workload around the office, employees said that the example set by their bosses resonated. Wait, what do you think about that?
I don't know. You would think
what is like taking time off?
Well, yeah. I mean, and I suppose that it's the same kind of quandary that we are all in, is that it's hard to take time off and get disengaged and then turn around and come back and be reengaged. I ended up taking 3 days off for the Memorial weekend, right? And that was the first days off that I had taken, and I think the count was like 34 days or something. Like, I just kept working through the weekend and got to a point where I'm super burnt out. But you're afraid to walk away for that long because then you have to come back, and that Tuesday was a little bit of a challenge. It was like, wow, I'm back. Okay, think. And so I think part of that statistic, I think, is probably wrapped up in that idea. And that we, as a society, we're really hard workers. I mean, it's just our American culture,
right,
by and large.
Well,
driven, you know, hard workers. So particularly business owners, you have a hard time letting go and walking away. So while I can understand men being a little hesitant to take it off, I would have to guess that it's not just because they are concerned how it's going to affect them, say, with the boss or the company, but it's also that walking away is for a length of time, because when you go off on maternity leave, you're gone, you know, 6 weeks.
You're completely disengaged.
Right. And that's a little bit of
what that's like.
Hey,
you want to hear something? You want to hear something funny? Are you ready for a laugh?
Hmm.
So I got an email from a buddy of mine who is an insurance professional.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he was at a restaurant in Fresno and overheard a few millennials having their laughs on a Friday night talking about, you know, the challenges of their age group, right?
Right.
Millennial. And one of them was bragging, oh my gosh, I'm so busy. I'm clocking at about 30 hours a week of work.
What?
So when he shared that on Facebook, actually he shared it on Facebook and he's my friend, so I saw it. And I was literally, that was I said that would be 2.5 days for me or 2 days, right? But this person was actually bragging about the fact that they were actually working 30 hours, which is the legal definition of full-time to get some benefits in some companies, right? But does that tell you something about the generational gap?
No, I think it just, I think this person was probably just young because we were all there to some point when we were young, but then life hits you.
Hey, we're still young.
Well, we're still young, but life hits you along the way.
We're not
and
young.
You start to figure out, well, wait a minute. If I want that car or if I want that house, if I want to grow up and maybe I want a vacation, I need to start getting in the groove. And then there's those of us who find that we enjoy the process. I would work for free. I would work and I would not charge anybody.
Because you love what you do.
Because I love what I do.
Wow.
But I still need to pay the bills. So unfortunately, clients who may be listening, I still have to charge. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you still have to pay too. If you're a client, you got to pay Claudine. That's right.
Yeah, unfortunately.
But I think what you're talking about is really very 70. I've read articles that 70% of the workforce wishes they were working elsewhere or doing something.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's super sad.
So for you to say that you could do what you do for free.
Oh, absolutely.
And the fact that you found your passion.
Absolutely.
Kudos to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I am absolutely convinced myself that I am doing what I was born to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't help it, right? I don't know when to stop working. And then people call me and I'm hitting, and my wife sometimes gets upset because I give too much knowledge away. You should be charging for this knowledge. But I love doing what I do. And yes, we have to take care of our families. But back to this whole thing, I thought it was funny. I wanted to share it. Hey, so you have some legal briefing, some stuff that you...
good
stuff.
We have talked about, wage hour law and the lawsuits that come along with it. And I actually read this, was reading a settlement that was a tentatively agreed to that's going to be proposed to the court on a lawsuit that is extremely common. This is extremely, extremely common. This is a wage hour lawsuit that has elements of overtime or non-payment for overtime, as well as not getting your meal and rest breaks. So that is the vast majority of wage hour lawsuits that are filed by employees are over not being paid correctly and not getting your meal and rest breaks. So a $1.25 million settlement was agreed to by a child care chain that has about 1,600 employees. And they're settling out of before they go to trial, of course. And they
for 1.25.
1.25 is the settlement.
And distributed about how many, amongst how many employees?
1,600.
Oh, all 1,600.
Okay, so yes, because, and I don't know if we've talked about it on the show before, but there are what is referred to as PAGA lawsuits or Private Attorney General Act of 2004, which allows an employee to sue on behalf of other employees. And they stand in the place of the Attorney General's office. And then, so they also have their lawsuit going. So it's like, it's essentially a double class action.
Hmm.
So anyway, the settlement came down at 1.25. How much do you think the attorneys got of that?
Okay, hold on. I'm doing some numbers right now. Divided by 1,600 employees. So what? That can't be right. 1,250, divided into 1,600. $781 per employee, but okay, that would be the entire amount minus 40% of the attorneys.
Well,
right?
What's going to the attorneys is $492,000.
Okay, so 492 divided into 1,125,
and then there's a $75,000 is going to the California Labor and Workforce Development Agency because they're suing on behalf of the Attorney General's office and the labor board.
So how much the attorney gets?
$492,000.
So that divided into 1,125, that's 43.7%.
Okay. And that includes some out-of-pocket costs that the attorneys have fronted as well. So it's not just the legal fees, but the workers are going to split $620,000. And then we have some various costs for administrative fees and so forth. But this is a call to employers all over to ensure that your employees are being given rest breaks and meal breaks, track it, come up with a way so that you're monitoring this, because these things are, you can defend these cases.
Wow. Well, so this is just one little tittle bit of juicy legal stuff.
And I've got another one on Disney.
Hold your thoughts. Hey, so you're listening to Business and Legal Talk. We have to go to break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. We're talking about buy-sell agreements. Stay tuned. Welcome back. Are you still with us?
I am.
Well, I know you are, but talking to our audience, are you still with us? This Business and Legal Talk. We're still Leo. We're still Claudine. And we're talking about, hey, the things that matter to you as a business owner. And that is our audience in here in the Central Valley. And we're talking about buy-sell agreements. So let's kind of get into it now.
Okay.
So take us there.
So buy-sell agreements are just a way of kind of forward thinking a lot of what ifs. If you're in a partnership, you should, or if you're in a corporation that has multiple shareholders, absolutely should have some game plan for what ifs. So what if one of the shareholders, or what if your business partner dies? And those shares are an asset that can be transferred and will be transferred through the deceased estate. So the heir can become the owner of those shares. So you may ultimately end up being in partnership or in business with the heirs of your partner.
How often do you run into that there's no buy-sell agreement between at least two owners?
Oh, most all the time. A lot. I would say got to be 75%, got to be. We're real good at setting up the corporation, getting the bylaws done and all of that.
And you did the buy-sell agreement at the outset.
We should do it at the outset. But a lot of people are, you know, a lot of tax folks are setting up corporations for their clients. And they file the articles of incorporation and so forth. And they kind of do the initial stuff. But I don't see them, you know, getting into the buy-sell agreements. Those are kind of, that's when you start to kind of step over and you're practicing law and you should have some contract experience and so forth. So you should absolutely have in place, because you could wake up and be in partnership with, or an ex. What happens if your partner divorces and his ex-wife or her ex-husband says, wait a minute, I want part of that company. You own 50% of that company and I'm entitled to my share.
No, instead of California's community property.
That's correct.
Unless there was a prenuptial, and that's a whole other thing.
That's correct. Right? That's
a whole other TV show.
That's a whole other TV show for sure. But buy-sell agreements are something that can be done easily. It doesn't have to be extremely complicated. What we need to do is figure out what is the agreement? So if you and I are in business together and we set up an arrangement that says, if I die tomorrow... So this is how a very common way to set it up. If I die tomorrow, the company is paying life insurance on you and life insurance on me.
Canceling insurances, yeah.
Yep. So if I die, the life insurance goes to my heirs in exchange for the shares that my heirs would be entitled to.
Mm.
Or the shares go to you directly and the cash goes to the heirs.
The life insurance.
Or we split the life insurance, because when we lose one of our partners, we lose a revenue generator, ideally. And so some money stays within the corporation so that the corporation can sustain itself and take the hit of losing one of the partners. And some money goes to the family, or some money doesn't have to. It's a contract. You can do it any way you want. You can also create buy-sell agreements with people outside of your business. So, for example, if I could create a buy-sell agreement with another law firm, another attorney in town, and say, hey, if I die tomorrow, you get all my files, you get my whole entire business, and, we create the price today, and maybe we reevaluate it every 3 years or something like that. But essentially, we create a contract today to resolve that problem for tomorrow.
Wow. So, I mean, I got a lot of, you know, I did some research. I was actually the researcher for this show. So wow. I found some research, but I thought I always knew that you were the one. So if I am a business owner, so the obvious one is death, right? What other triggers when you sit down with your the potential things that can happen? And how do you factor valuations? I mean, how do you go about it? I guess, so found this article, 6 things to know about buy-sell agreements. You want to walk us through that and what are some of the assumptions are?
Go ahead.
So it says here they should be developed early. I think you just covered that.
Right.
It says buy-sell agreements should include a business valuation clause.
Absolutely. And that just to define it, because, you know, I like to define things so we're all on the same page. And that is really the clause of, how do we evaluate the shares? What method do we use? And you can probably explain the mm-hmm. various methods. But there are multiple different types of ways of evaluating the business. So,
okay, so let me chime in. So there should be a mechanism. And if you're going to really, we're going to throw the word valuation out there, it shouldn't be thrown lightly. A true valuation involves outside parties who are competent and experts in the subject of valuations that are going to do this very comprehensive. It's like an appraisal. Okay, it's no different than if you were going to purchase or sell a home. You want an appraiser appraising the house, right? And this appraiser would have a license, and they would have to go through a 150, I'm just guessing, point inspection, and structurally the foundation of the house, and go through these checks, and to arrive at all the, you know, comparable and the comps in the similar houses and the similar makeup and the roof, where all of that is going to spit out at the end a evaluation of the house, which is an appraisal of the house, which really is a guess,
right?
At the end of the day,
right?
But it is a guess based on a professional who knows what they're doing, or we hope they know what they're doing, And there are software that does that. So the same happens for a business. I'm only using the real estate because it's something that everybody knows.
Right.
But it's a little more gray on the business side. But there are still some ways that if you're really going to do it right, you would want to hire a third-party valuation, like whether it's a CPA firm or a financial firm who has an expertise in valuations. But to keep it simple, I would tell a business owner, you have to come to an agreement together at what the business is worth. And there's a couple of ways we can do that. One, we can say a multiple of, you know, 1x revenue or 1.25. And it could be depending on the industry, right? If businesses, what are similar businesses and similar industries selling for? Well, there's businesses usually sell on a multiple of revenue.
Mm-hmm.
A multiple of earnings or EBITDA, right? Earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, or a multiple of discretionary cash flow, which is, you know, the income plus all the owner-related expenses that get added into the P&L to lower your income tax.
Got it.
So that spits out a number, right? Discretionary cash flow, which is like when you are the owner and add all these things, basically you expense things throughout the business that you're legally
right.
allowed to,
right?
Which you actually make a lot more money than what your net income says.
Right.
Those are, this people can play around with those.
Well, let me tell you, that'll the source, you want to see a source of a fight.
It's that.
It's going to be that. Because the spouse, let's say, for example, we have a spouse that passed away. And the spouse that is deceased was the shareholder. And now we have, say, the surviving spouse. And the surviving spouse has maybe become accustomed to a lot of those expenses that were coming through the business. You know, maybe we were driving the vehicle that the business was paying for, and maybe we enjoyed the insurance that was being paid for through the company, and maybe we enjoyed some stuff. And we have a vision that the company is worth a certain dollar figure because of what we've been expensing through the company. But it turns out that when we shake the tree and figure it all out and the dust settles, the company is really not worth what we anticipated it being worth. Then do I want to sell my shares? Let's just say I'm left with the shares and I have the opportunity to sell them. But the value of the shares is not that much. I would maybe rather take the Escalade that the company's been, you know, leasing for me, and, you know, some of the other expenses. So then I want to hold on to my shares. And maybe I decided that you're not really running the business very well, and I'm now a 50% owner. and I want my vote.
Wow. So I think that there are a lot of things that you can play with that you can actually rig to your advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Because you can put this in writing ahead of time and then none of these things become a factor. It's in writing. The evaluation method, it is what it is. That's the agreement. We do it in a shareholder agreement, do it in a buy-sell agreement. But we outline the method ahead of time, and then we have the guidance when that event actually happens.
The most common way is net income, a multiple of net income, right? As right. defined in the actual buy-sell.
Right.
And it could be 4 times earnings before tax. Okay, whatever that is, right? Subject to a third-party approval. Okay, so we make sure that everybody keeps their hands clean. So that was number two. So here are the 6 things that we're talking about. The business should know about buy-sell agreements. One, they should be developed early. They should include a buy-sell agreement. Business valuation clause and a mechanism for it. Number three, they can reduce emotional impact.
Oh,
right?
For sure.
We don't make our best decisions when we're emotional.
That's absolutely true. Ask any probate attorney.
Right? When you get emotions on the way, it's fertile ground for bad things to happen.
Yep.
How do divorce lawyers handle things?
I don't know. I can't imagine. I know several really good ones, and they're wonderful people, but I can't imagine practicing law and dealing with divorces. I can't. But, you know, three come to mind, and they're all fantastic attorneys, and they're great people, and they're not jaded and horrible or anything like that.
And they don't take any of that stuff home.
No, they're just wonderful people, but it takes the right personality.
So number four, they should include ground rules. And by that is not only how the price is determined, but who can or can be a buyer, or how the business sale will be funded. Which is, you know, how are we going to fund this buy sell, which we were talking about earlier. You know, life insurance is kind of usually one of the go-to, a clause outlining what may trigger the sale of the company can prevent having fiduciary agents such as lenders take control in the event of a personal bankruptcy, which happens, right?
Right.
So number five is valuation methods matter. Okay, we talked about that in a little bit. And number six, buy-sell agreements have tax implications. There's two things that are certain, death and taxes. Well, you cannot neglect the taxes, right? And
we recently worked on a buy-sell agreement for one of our clients, and the shareholders, one of the shareholders wanted to retire, and the other two did not want to retire. And, you know, we came up with a method of evaluation. And, you know, ultimately it was even though that was very planned and it was well negotiated, the players all worked out the terms that, you know, amongst themselves, and it was all very calm and cool and collected, and, you know, it was not the source of some, you know, a really bad situation. It was still very emotional.
Really?
It was very emotional. When the one who wanted to retire, when he actually left, it was emotional that, you know, I suppose you're switching into a new phase in life.
Right.
And yes, you know, yes, the purchase price was fantastic, and that will, you know, be you know, something that goes into the retirement forever, and it is great. So, but even though, going back to the emotion thing, even still, it can be very emotional, even under the best of plans.
How often do you find, let me ask you this. How often is it something that is brought to you as an interest of the owner before you having to kind of bring it up? Is it something that you are finding yourself more asking the business owners, or are they coming to you with it?
Rarely do they come to us with it. Rarely have they even ever thought about it. Rarely. Really? Everybody's so focused on
it. So you point it out. Start,
yeah. As this is a component to a healthy business. This is the component that everybody's really good at getting it started, getting it, you know, the articles filed and all of that business. We're really, really great at starting things. And this is classic of any contract. We're very good in the beginning, but are we effective at predicting all of the what ifs that could happen down the road, and then providing the guidance for the what if in the contract? And that's basically what this is. This is you're providing the guidance for the rest of everybody else, the rest of the shareholders, the rest of the family, you know, whatever it may be, you're providing the guidance for that day that either I want to get out or I'm, you know, without my choice, am out. It's the how we're going to do this piece.
So before I get, you know, we're about to go into break, so I don't want to start any new topics, but, you know, this is important. Hey, you should be listening, paying attention, you know, buy-sell agreements. You know, most people don't know about them, so you should. In fact, that you're listening to our show right now tells us that you're very interested, so thank you so much. We'll be right back with Business and Legal Talk with Lee and Claudine after the break. Hey, welcome back. Thank you. Our gracious producer just, I was actually talking already and my mic was off. So thank you very much. Our very own illustrious Luke, our producer. Hey, welcome back. Beautiful Saturday. Lots going on, but we're talking about buy-sell agreements here in the studio. And it could be very fun.
Yeah, absolutely. No.
If you're ready.
Buy-sell agreements are actually a lot easier to contemplate and to decide on and work through than an estate plan. A lot of folks avoid the whole concept of estate planning because you're really planning for, you know, after you die. And buy-sell agreements are not necessarily for protecting you or protecting your assets if you die, but it works in that way as well. So they're very good, but it's really a great exit strategy plan. This is how you want to kind of think about it. How am I going to leave this business that I have put 20 or 30 years of my life into, cared for it like a child, and you know, just sacrifice so much for it? You don't want to just walk away and have it disintegrate into nothing. So we, you know, back to the buy-sell agreements, there's several different types that you can do. You can have a buy-sell agreement, which is very common just between, say, two owners or maybe two businesses that are not co-owned. For example, it would be like me having another law firm create an agreement to purchase my business should something happen to me. And those are typically referred to as cross-purchase agreements.
Oh,
just,
okay.
Just between a couple of people. Then we have the stock redemption agreement. And
please enlighten me.
Stock redemption agreement is says that I can sell my shares back to the corporation because the corporation is a separate entity and it can own the shares as well. So, for example, if there's 100 shares and there's two shareholders, and let's say on a personal level, I would need to raise a little bit of capital, which I know is something we've talked about. We can have an agreement in our shareholder agreement that allows me to sell my shares back to the corporation.
Mm, okay.
And then the corporation owns them. And then if the corporation ever needs to raise capital, the corporation then has shares that it can sell.
Right.
Now, of course, we'd be bringing in another owner.
Right.
You know, so that brings on a whole nother, you know, conversation. But then we can also have a combination. A combination agreement, the structure gives the owners the option to do either a direct buy sell with another owner or to sell it back to the corporation. It will determine the right of a first right of refusal. And so essentially that's the one thing that we have to iron out. So if I have a combination agreement that says I can either make the choice to sell shares to the other shareholders that are existing within the business, or I can sell it to outside, or I can sell it back to the corporation. Typically, the other shareholders within the corporation want first right of refusal, which means that I get the first choice to say, yes, I want it. And only if I reject it, does it get sold back to the corporation. The other thing to be very, very careful of, and I mentioned it a couple of times, is you know, creating a buy-sell agreement with somebody outside of your corporation. That's great if you're a sole shareholder. Mm. If you're in a partnership, that is something you need to be very, very careful with. And both partners really need to be on board with the same idea. So there's, say, for example, there's two partners in my law firm, and we decide together that if something were to happen to me or my other shareholder, we will sell to, you know, a third party firm outside of us. It's doable. Again, in the world of contracts, anything's doable. We can contract for anything. There's literally no limits other than just a very few that would make a contract void. But by and large, we can agree to do whatever we want. So it's always doable, but you want to be very, very careful if you are creating a situation where there will be an automatic new owner or new partner.
Okay. So let me stop you right there. So I've realized now by doing this show that the average listener is not going to sit here the entire hour.
Right.
They're coming and go. So if you're just tuning into this show, we've been talking about business buy-sell agreements between business owners. So here's the obvious question. When does a business need a buy-sell agreement?
From the day you open, in my opinion. It should be part of the comprehensive starting of a business. When we do the business plan, when we file the articles of incorporation, when we draft the bylaws, we should be thinking about this as well.
One of the things that impressed me the most when we first met, that you are very proactive in
right.
the way you work with your clients. So from cradle to grave, whatever, but really you get with your clients once a year and you actually look at, make sure that they're fully protected, all the legal documents are in right. place for the business. And so this is something that you're constantly bringing up.
We do. And we do try to have at least one sit down a year with our clients where we discuss just the corporation. There are some corporations, some businesses that are looking at and modifying and dealing with corporate matters throughout the year because of their size and so forth, or they have people coming and going. And so we have to adjust the bylaws, or we have to adjust shareholder agreements and things like that. Most of the time I find that clients, once they set up the entity and it gets the articles of incorporation are filed, or, you know, the partnership is created. Once we do that, we go on about whatever the business does, and we don't circle back around to deal with corporate matters. And it's critical. It's critical that we do it. So this is one of the corporate matters that is just part of the whole corporate housekeeping bucket.
Okay, so we're talking probably to a new audience that hasn't heard some of these things
right.
before. Hey, let me ask you this.
This is not just for corporations. I don't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead.
But just in the effort to, I don't want people listening to think that this is just for corporations. If you're in a partnership, this applies to you. If you're in a limited partnership, if you're in an LLC, if you're in
a PC,
anything other than a sole proprietor,
right?
This applies to you.
What happens if a company needs to but can't afford to buy one of the owners out?
Well, and that's where life insurance is usually the go-to. We can also sell assets. You know, so for example, if the company owns property, let's say maybe it owns the building it's in, and that is a real issue. So when we are looking at it, it's not just the logistics of who would buy who for how much. It's
and where the money is coming from.
And we're back to raising capital again, that place again. And so life insurance is oftentimes the vehicle. It's a very easy vehicle, particularly if the shareholders or the partners are younger. You can buy life insurance on each other, and you can start off, you know, obviously the younger you are, the higher the bill is. And you can have that life insurance policy split. And I mentioned that a little earlier. It's very easy to have the life insurance split, and we recommend it actually, so that part of it goes to whoever would be the owner. But the life insurance only comes into play in the event that the shareholder or the partner dies. How do we do it if the person says, I just want to leave the corporation. I don't want to do this business anymore. And I have 50 shares or I have 150 shares or whatever. And I want to sell them. If we haven't dealt with it in the bylaws or in the shareholder agreement, those shares are your property right. You can go sell them. You can put them out on the market. You can find a buyer for them. And that now brings on a whole nother set of circumstances, because now do the remaining shareholders, or does the remaining partner want to have a voice as to who do you sell them to? Who are, you know, you're selling your shares, you're walking away, that's great. But now I'm going to be in business with somebody I don't even know. And so this is where we deal with it at the inception part. And if we haven't dealt with it at the inception part, and let's just say we're 10 years into this business, we can go back and modify the shareholder agreement or the bylaws to incorporate it. But we may have to take out a loan. I've worked with businesses where the shareholder took out a loan, or we did a promissory note. We've done promissory notes where the person, the remaining shareholders, drafted or executed a promissory note that said, I will pay X amount of dollars over the course of, you know, X amount of years.
Like a structural settlement, basically. Yeah.
And so basically that's going to come out of the profit of the corporation.
That's very good. Do you address capital calls within the buy sell agreement, or do we have that in the bylaws?
We will typically have it in a buy sell.
So company needs to raise, let me give you throw a hypothetical example. The company needs to raise capital to the tune of $100,000. And there is three shareholders, and say they're all 33, 33, and 33 and a third, whatever that it works out to. Maybe that's not a good example, but there's two 50-50, and each one needs to raise 50,000, so 100,000. What happens if one comes up with the money and the other one does it?
That's going to be in your bylaws or your shareholder agreement. And, you know, that there is no quick answer. There's no just one-way answer. That, again, back to the idea contract. And back to the idea of trying to forecast all of the what ifs.
Right.
And that's a great what if. So then the question would be back to the remaining shareholders. So what do we do? Do we liquidate something? Does the corporation have money that it can lend? But if you're raising capital, presumably no. The answer is no. So then do the other ones take over more shares?
People underestimate, right, the power of that equity, the power of those shares that they hold within.
It's the most expensive thing that you'll sell.
Right. I think people they throw the word equity around like it's just fashionable.
Right.
Right, and without really fully understanding. And the reason why we're talking about this is you should seriously, as a business owner, think carefully about when to part with equity. And I think there are times when it's absolutely necessary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always say, you know, because I have helped and I'm actually actively helping companies raise capital for different, not all the money for your business is going to come from a loan or the SBA. There are times when you have to take an opportunity to market that the banks are not going to want to give you. They're not going to give you any capital. You don't qualify for it. Your ratios are out of line. You know, your current ratio, your current liabilities, it's not in line with the current assets and et cetera. So you got to go outside to private investors, mm-hmm. and they're going to want equity, and that equity is very expensive. But they'll argue, okay, well, do you rather have 100% of a company that is worth zero or 25% of a $10 million company?
Right.
Some people will argue, hey, I want to have a smaller fraction of a more successful company. But that comes with rules, right? And rules of engagement,
right?
And the sophisticated investors are going to know those rules, and you need to be equipped. And I guarantee you they're going to have some buy-sell, a very strong buy-sell agreement,
right? Absolutely. And one of the advantages of working with somebody who does this on a regular basis is they have experienced the pitfalls. So in my world, I see on a daily basis that which most people see once or maybe twice in their career.
That's really, really, really good. But I want you to hold on to that thought, because we're going to come back to it. I've been told that we need to go to break. Why?
Why?
Because that's what's necessary. So thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. You're listening to Business and Legal Talk with Lee and Claudine. Hey, welcome back. This is what are we anyway? Business and Legal Talk with Ian Claudine. It's been a long week.
It has been a long week.
And it's only Saturday.
I know. Well, I know.
I'm out of gas already.
This is actually the end of our week.
Well,
and we're still working. But well, we're not working. We're having fun. We're doing what we do.
But we're also being real, right? And what you'll get from us is being transparent. But hey, so we paused and we were talking about, or have we been having fun with buy-sell agreements? And there's just a lot of questions. And you had, the importance of equity. That's what we're talking about.
Yes.
And where do we want to go with this? I mean, which way do you want to go?
Well, you know, when we talk about buy-sell agreements and using life insurance and stuff, I think everybody, if people right now, if you're out there listening and you're thinking to yourself, wow, this is maybe something I can tackle this year. I should start really making a plan for, you know, the sales of the business if I should die or what, you know, rather than just letting it go into, you know, thin air and disintegrate. Know that one part of the puzzle is to also cultivate somebody within the business who can take over your role and who can perform the tasks that you perform. And that's something that's really, really important. And a lot of times I see business owners cultivating their purchaser. And maybe that purchaser is going to be somebody who is not a shareholder of the business or not your current partner.
Okay.
But it's somebody who's been faithfully working in the business, enjoys the business, knows the business, and is agreeable to step into that role should something happen to you. Again, we can go back to life insurance to fund it if that's possible. If not, perhaps the person that you're cultivating could get a loan, would be willing to sign a promissory note and take proceeds out of the business each year to pay on the promissory note. There are tax implications because when you use life insurance typically is not taxed.
Right.
But there are tax implications when you start to do buy-sell agreements. So that is something that we leave for the CPA or the tax person, and we want to always, always, always loop them in the conversation.
Correct.
When we say, okay, this is what we're thinking, tell me what the tax implications are. That's how we approach it, because I do absolutely zero tax conversations at all.
And, you know, for the record, I am, there's so much to keep up. It's a full-time job to keep up with the changes in the tax code. As you know, there was the biggest sweeping change of the tax code in the last 20 years happened last year in 2018.
Right. And most people don't even barely understand it.
Far be it from me to, you know, talk about that. That's not my area of expertise. I care more about helping the business be profitable and throughout the year in the managerial accounting as a CFO. But with that said, I think the operative word is income. And what is determined as income? Because all roads lead back to your 1040, right?
Right, right.
So LLCs, PCs, S-Corps, they're all pass-through entities. So the income will be swept from in a form of a K-1, right?
Right.
You get your W-2 income if you have a salary, and then you add that to your, and then you get your K-1, right, coming through. And what is determined? Income. And I don't know whether making the argument. So if my spouse got a windfall from a life benefit, would that be considered income?
I don't know. I reserve that for the tax person. And perhaps there's a tax person out there that is just itching to answer that question. Give us a call.
And we need to bring that's a great guest to have, right? Somebody who actually has all these intricacies on working with bigger companies because they're, what is a taxable event?
Right.
But it's good problem to have if you have all this money coming in, right? The whole problem with taxes is they actually have income. So it's not a problem to pay taxes if you're making money. I'd rather you be paying taxes than not making any money at all.
Right.
And you have zero tax liability, but you're going to be going out of business, which would you rather have? Fun times. Well, good. This is good stuff. This is good stuff. So I have this question for you. You know, I'm not sure if, you know, bankruptcy. Can a co-owner's personal bankruptcy affect the business?
Absolutely, because your bankruptcy is going to be looking at all of your assets and what you own.
So and what happens to the shares that you own?
If you own shares. And that's a very good question. And that is something that bankruptcy attorneys are going to be weighing in on.
But you may not be able to, because there's a threshold that you have to have of assets. If you have way more assets and they say your shares are equal to above the threshold of what you're allowed, legally allowable, right. You may not be able to file bankruptcy.
It's definitely an effect, and that's one of the things that you definitely are dealing with at the last minute, so to speak, rather than the plan ahead stuff, which is more of what we deal with. But definitely, if you own shares of a company and you're personally trying to file bankruptcy, you know, that's where you want to make sure that you've got a bankruptcy attorney on hand that understands how to incorporate that, because the shares are the shares. They have a value. Right. Just as we've talked about, you know, valuation, it is what it is. They are there. So it's like a vehicle. So you have a vehicle that could be worth $20,000, or you can have a vehicle that's worth, you know, $200. The shares are worth the shares. And there's going to be questions by the bankruptcy trustee as to what's the value, how are we going to evaluate the shares and so forth.
This, you know, this can be increasingly complex.
Yes.
And the bigger the business gets. So I encourage you, if you're growing a business, it would be foolish to go at it without the help of the professionals in the areas of expertise. I always say, do what you do best and bring professionals for the rest. And I stand by that, because there's no possible way that if you're running any type of business, you're going to know every area of the business. Right? And even you who are expert in law, you'd realize that there are some areas that of the business that you don't really understand.
Right.
So for these matters of buy-sell agreements and the tax implications thereof, you got to have professionals and different experts, not just lawyers, but lawyers with expertise in the subject matter.
Right. And that's one of the things about our industry that's really important for people to understand, is that attorneys, we typically stay in a certain lane, depending on where our area of expertise is or area of experience. Our industry is broken into so many smaller areas of expertise. So there are people who literally do nothing but evaluations of like retirement plans. So when like divorces, when you go through a divorce and let's say husband and wife have been contributing, you know, husband's been contributing to his retirement plan, you know, for the first 10 years of the marriage, and then they get divorced and the wife is entitled to her community share portion of it, but her community share portion doesn't come until retirement age. Meanwhile, that money sits there and grows, but at the end, it's not worth, you know, it's not a clear cut path to what her portion would have been worth on that day of divorce versus what is her portion worth on the day at age 65 of retirement. So, I mean, that's kind of a long example, but our industry is broken up into very small areas. I mean, there are labor employment attorneys who literally focus on about 15 or 20 labor codes.
That's it.
That's their area of expertise.
Wow.
So it's absolutely important. You know, what we do is we do general business upkeep, general business keeping, business bookkeeping, not bookkeeping in the term of, you know, numbers bookkeeping.
Legal bookkeeping.
Yeah, the corporate housekeeping.
There's so many keepings.
I know, right?
So, all right, anyway, so let's bring it home. So we're talking about sustainable and profitable. So definitely today was about being sustainable.
Yes.
And I know real life cases in which you're making me think about, do some of my clients have buy-sell agreements in place? Most of the businesses that I work with are multiple owners that are non-related.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our family, but even I think it doesn't discriminate. So you have a husband and wife, or you have a brother and sister. Even more than ever, right? More of a reason to have a buy-sell agreement, because things get emotional.
I have one client that I work with who will obviously remain nameless. Large company here in the Valley. Large company. Husband and wife started it and have been in the business for 20 plus years, and they got divorced. But they stayed in the business because those shares were of value. It was their income. It was their personal income.
So they worked together.
Divorced. Both remarried.
and still they remain partners.
And still remain partners.
Oh, my goodness.
And the business is absolutely thriving. It's a fantastic business here in the Central Valley.
Really?
And, you know, that is really a testament to the value of equity and what it can really encourage us to do. To be reasonable, be sane. Let's not blow up the business just because we decide we don't want to, you know, remain married. But we each have a job in the business and we have a responsibility to the business and we continue to work for the business.
Wow.
And it is possible, but that was because somebody stopped and thought about and
so
said
they did have a buy sell agreement.
No, I'm not sure that they did in the very beginning, but at the point that they got to the fork in the road, they made a conscientious decision of what we're going to do. And that was the decision that they made.
That's fascinating. So we have been listening and I've been talking to people and we've been communicating. We're thinking of great show topics to come in the next, you know, and guests over the next few weeks and months. We really love doing the show. It speaks to something that we're passionate. I think you and me both love to teach and give the knowledge that we have, that we have earned over many years. And we want to put that knowledge to use. And, you know, we both volunteer in different organizations. Mm-hmm. And we give away our time. And if you take one thing away from what we talked about, particularly in buy sell, is you gotta just go back, press and reset, go back and look at your legal, if you have any, but if you have a partner, you better have a buy sell agreement.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'll tell you, it's something that should be revisited over years. So if you, let's say your corporation or your business, you know, was created 15 years ago and things have been going wonderful, things may have changed. Your valuations obviously should have changed. Hopefully they have changed. And we may need to readdress life insurance policy limits. We may need to just readdress how the buy-sell agreement is drafted. Over time, just like anything else, we draft things differently now than we did draft them maybe 15, 20 years ago. Language is a little bit different styles, different way of going about it. I read living trusts that were drafted 25 years ago and it's completely, just a different, the elements are still the same, but the way we went about drafting it. Whereas now I find they're a lot cleaner language, a lot more straightforward language. So, you know, those are things that you want to look at. Your buy-sell agreement, shareholder agreements, those things should be addressed.
Well, thank you, Claudine. Great stuff today. I thank you for, you know, you're always giving us, you know, the actionable and great expertise. Thank you, everyone, for tuning into today's show. It was a pleasure having you. And thank you so much for always turning into Business and Legal Talk with Leo, Claudine. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you.